Welcome to another storied episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jen. This week our topic is Fables by Bill Willingham, and now the cast begins.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another storybook episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with David.
Hello.
And Jen.
Heyo.
And this week, we read Fables, Volume 1, titled Legends in Exile. This is from 2002. It's the first five issues of the series, written by Bill Willingham and art by... I don't remember his name. I didn't catch it. Jen, you have the comic in front of you. You say it.
The penciler was Lan Medina, and we have two inkers, Steve, Lealoha, I hope I said that correctly, and Craig Hamilton.
Oh, I've heard Lealoha before, so he's done other things.
Sherilyn Van Valkenburg was the colorist, and Todd Klein, who has done a million and two things, was the letterer. Mm-hmm.
So what did you guys think of this one? This is the opening to our like fantasy comics art. And I thought this would be a good bridge because it's kind of fantasy, but it's not like pure fantasy stories like we're going to get into with like Conan and Red Sonja, maybe later if we get to that. And next week's Camelot 3000, like those are hard fantasy. This is kind of fantasy, but kind of not. What did you guys think of this?
Maybe I should go first so we can have some healthy discussion here.
All right, let's hear it.
All right, so... this is my experience reading the comic. Okay. I read it last night, and after I put it down, I promptly started reading something else. And I started thinking about it, and I thought, you know, I didn't really care about that comic at all. And I think I know why. Hmm. And it's the same reason why I don't care about Walking Dead anymore. It's because this kind of thing is just, this is what pop culture is nowadays. There's that one show, Once Upon a Time, right?
And that's that
basically.
Show.
I'm not saying that I like that show better. I'm just saying that I feel a little bit like there's too much of this. Just like there's too many zombies.
You know what? I totally see your point. I had the same problem in last October. We did the was it this last October? Or was it the October before? I don't remember. We did like a horror arc, and we did American Vampire, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that comic wasn't bad, but I remember just hating it because it was like the year of inundation of all vampire crap. And I mean, I know we're still inundated with vampire crap, but like last year just seemed to be the worst.
And see, like the other thing is there's another TV show called Grimm. I don't know if you guys have watched that.
Oh, I've heard of that one, though.
Mm-hmm.
I actually like that show, but it's not really the same as... it's not in the same vein as Fable or Once Upon a Time. So, I didn't, just like Andy said, I didn't think this was a bad comic. I just didn't feel anything about, like, by reading it. Maybe if I read more than just the first five issues, like, it just didn't seem special to me, which... I feel bad for feeling that way, but because it's not this comic's fault. So I'm trying to like separate it from the time that I read it, but I guess that's kind of one of the things about literature is I know this isn't a literature podcast, but to me, literature has always been like a book or a story that is not tied down. It's, you know, it represents its time, but it's not tied down to the time that it was created. And I don't know, I feel like this is unfortunately being dragged down by everything around it, so.
This comic feels too much like a product of its era, is what you're trying to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can see that. And honestly, this is my first time reading this. I started reading this a couple years ago, and I've read quite a few volumes. I think I've read, like... I want to say 10 or 11 volumes of this. And what keeps you going past the first volume, at least what kept me going, is that you look at these characters and they're classic characters, and this is a great reinterpretation, I think, of them, especially, not that these characters are interpreted differently or exist differently than they were before. The shtick is that they are the same, but they're real and they're in our world, out of place, when they were from that world. Like, the shtick is in the setting. It's in a reinterpretation and a replacement of these characters, not necessarily on creating them anew. And I think reading it, like, you see how Big B Wolf, Big Bad Wolf, right? You see how his character is reinterpreted for this comic, and you look at characters like Snow White and Cinderella and all of these kind of characters, and the draw to keep reading is to see who some of the other background characters are, and maybe you can figure it out. You know, like, there's a couple frames of an old witch woman who tends to be really important, and she's like, she was the gingerbread house witch, you know?
Right.
And she ends up being really important, you know, and it's like seeing these background characters who become something more and that remind you of the stories, it sort of taps into that nostalgia, but puts that nostalgia somewhere new. But that is a shtick that doesn't last, right? And I think that's part of what's wrong with this comic. If we're going to point out things that are wrong, don't get me wrong, I like this comic, but I mean, what was it, Aristotle and his list of the important things to have in a piece of literature? Is spectacle, setting, plot, and story or character or something, and like setting was low on the list of importance. And that is this comic shtick is setting. Even though it does it incredibly well. And I think it really does bring power to that shtick, but at the end of the day it's still a shtick. Because I want to use the word shtick a lot more, apparently.
Yeah.
So
shtick it to the comic.
Yeah.
All right, Jen, you go.
I feel like I have a slightly alternate take on this because I had been meaning to read this and I asked for it for Christmas a few years ago and got it and I read it. And like David, I was kind of like, put it aside. The second read through was actually a lot better. And it's interesting because like earlier we mentioned Once Upon a Time and I was like vehemently like, fuck that show. And okay, so my housemate watches that show religiously, and it's really bad. It's just not what I want to see. And going back to this, I feel like this... when Once Upon a Time came out, a lot of people were like, you're just riffing off Fables. That's so messed up. You can't just steal their idea. And the creators of Fables actually very graciously responded by saying, you know, we don't think they're stealing our idea, but we're flattered that, you know, people see similarities. I feel like in view of Once Upon a Time and Grimm and, like, there was another one that was out, I can't remember the name of it, something similarly, like, Magical Town.
There's tons of stuff that has this feel, even if it's not, you know, fairy characters in modern life or, you know, storybook town. There's a lot of stuff that has this general feel nowadays.
Yeah.
I was going to say my wife actually watches Once Upon a Time and we both watch Grimm, but I watched some of the first seasons of Once Upon a Time and that's definitely the closest to Fables, but I definitely think that this is better than Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, and I think this comes out in contrast to those. Like, it's not the best comic I've ever read, but I think it's a good take. And, I mean, this is a Vertigo title. It's one of their flagships now that Sandman has been done with for, like, oh my god, 15 years or so, maybe.
They need a new flagship.
Yeah, and I mean, this feels very Vertigo. In fact, it does a lot of the same stuff Neil Gaiman does by taking characters we've seen elsewhere in stories and then putting them in a modern-day setting and being like, hey, here's a thing. But I think these characters are interesting in this, and I mean, that's more than I can say for some other shows, or like some other media using the same idea where I feel like they're just butchering the old stories. I feel like this is a nice Vertigo, like, a Vertigo take on it.
Mm-hmm. I think it works. I think you get these characters fleshed out the way that they are because of their interaction with setting. And do we want to talk about the plot, the setting, the character? Where do you guys want to start?
Well, let's talk about setting. Why not?
Yeah, that's like you said that that's its shtick, right, Andy?
Yes, that's what the word of choice was. So, I mean, I think that that's the most interesting thing that this story does, because it's so it would be so easy to take these characters and put them in that storybook kind of setting, because that's the closest to, or like the small rural village, right? Put them out in Smallville, like it. That sort of environment has as close to the feeling or the mood in literature and pop culture and media that where they come from has, you know? I mean, they come from this sort of place of medieval fealty. But these characters don't feel out of place, even though they're exiles, and their stories are often set in medieval fealties. And I think it's because they feel like full characters, like they're fleshed out, precisely because they've had to adapt to this setting, as opposed to being put somewhere that they would be used to. You know, they're put here in this big city that's not anything like where any of them come from. So before the story even starts, right, they've been here for a while and they've had to endure the hardship of moving here, the hardship of adapting and changing, and they've already done all of the hard work of character building before you even start reading it simply because of where it's set, right? I mean, and you get that sense because the characters are written well, right? A lot of them really do interact with the setting very well, and they're already established and they've already changed all the ways that you would expect them to. But I think it's because they're in New York City and not what do they call it, up at the farm, because they're not out in some mystical rural, you know, idealized farm setting. They're in friggin' New York City, the biggest of cities.
I feel like, especially for this story, because I haven't read the other volumes, but I get the strong impression they're going to be like these little short stories with the overarching plot. I feel like New York City, you know, if you can't choose L.A., choose New York for your gritty, like, detective noir novel. And I mean, this is great. It, in terms of detective fiction, I actually really liked it. If I view it from, like, that genre perspective, because it has, you know, the people that you're supposed to suspect, but, you know, who clearly didn't do it. You have, let's see, kind of clues that you have all the pieces as the reader, and it's up to you to figure out the same thing that Big Bad Wolf did. Mm-hmm. And you can, and that's the best part, except you don't.
Yeah, and there's a lot of comics like this where it comes to this point and you think, well, where did that clue come from? I never saw that, you know? I can't guess this part of the mystery because I didn't get that piece. But when he's retelling it, the narration is sort of laid over the scene and you get that picture, almost exact frame of what it was when he was there. And he's recalling it. Like when they talk about the way that the crime scene was laid out, right? The way that the blood was splattered and the way things were arrayed. You know, he was talking about the CDs in this place, the ashtray in this place, and how everything was just too perfect, but the kitchen was fine. And all of those details came frame for frame from when he was originally in that scene, the exact same way that you saw it. And I really like that. And it gives you those same details, like when he picks up the ashtray, and it's just set there perfectly. And you look at the CD rack and, you know, the bottom rack is full and the top rack is all fucked up and empty. You know, like it's those little details that you actually saw. And that's exactly where he got all of this stuff from.
Yeah. And you know what's also kind of cool? This story as a detective novel doesn't have a MacGuffin. And the MacGuffin is that, like, one driving thing that everyone's trying to go after, like, you know, the crown jewels or something, but, like, there's no real reason. It's a driving force without purpose. But here, like, okay, no one wants to marry Bluebeard. So it's pretty reasonable to go ahead and be like, well, she faked her death because she didn't want to marry a serial killer.
Yeah, and I like that it feels more realistic in terms of what a crime is like, because over the last year and a half, 2 years or so, I have been watching a lot more procedural crime shows because my fiance loves them. And what I've noticed is that they always try to figure out motive, like, motive is the grand thing that unlocks the crime. And there's always this underlying assumption in these shows that there's singular motive. That this person wants to kill this person for this reason. Like, this one reason is everything. But I like that in this mystery, there are multiple motives coming from multiple people that make it intertwine the way it does. Because Jack has his motives, which are independent of Rose Red's motives, which are independent entirely of Bluebeard's motives. Like, they all want these different things that make this twist in exactly the way that it does. But we just wandered way far away from setting.
Yeah, you totally went to character. What's with that?
Sorry. So, did you like this juxtaposition of the fantastical and the real? I mean, we talked about how it seems to be too popular of a thing. But, I mean, is it popular because it works? Does it not work here? I mean, I've obviously stuck my neck out saying that I like it, and I think it works here, because I think it helps flesh out these characters.
I think it works because it makes the characters seem more like real people. Whereas if you just stick them in, like, a cozy little magical town where they're still magical but no one cares, it's kind of like, well, why not just leave them in fairy tale land?
What about you, David? You were the one who was the most critical opening up.
I think the setting is fine. I think for the story that they tell on these five issues, this works really well. I mean, I think it's hard. I don't think it would be as good of a sell if it was a detective story in a small and like a bucolic setting. So in that regard, I think it works well. And I did like Bigby. So I don't know. I'm having trouble thinking of things to say about this. I thought the setting was interesting. I don't know. I feel like for a lot of the characters that this is a big departure, but, you know, so especially a character like Bigby, he's probably, you know, he's from the Three Little Pigs and Red Riding Hood, right?
Yeah.
So those are rural settings. But I don't necessarily know if people like Cinderella or some of the noble folk are necessarily that far removed from the type of things that they had before. In so much as like they live in a big structure, especially if they live in if they live in a castle or something. Because to me, like when I try to imagine what these characters look like I think where's Cinderella live? I think of like the Disney stuff. And even though they live in, like, kind of maybe, well, at least maybe Cinderella's not the best example, but the castle, that setting wasn't, like, I didn't think, man, this is a small-time deal. It's a very grandiose setting, so maybe...
Yeah, you get a big castle surrounded by a village, and the village is full of people.
Right, so it's not... I don't know if New York is that far removed from that kind of thing. I mean, it is, but... I don't know. I think the setting was fine. I didn't feel very strongly about it. So
okay.
Yeah.
So
oh, I actually had a question. In terms of living the lifestyle they're accustomed to, did you guys kind of notice everyone was like, "Oh, we're so poor now. We're so poor," yet they all have time to go to a charity gala where they invest in like a $3 million lottery?
Well, I think the people like Jack, I don't think he's the guy who's is participating in the auction, or Bigby, obviously.
Yeah, Jack bought just one ticket, as opposed even to like Beauty and Beast when they were complaining about, I mean, the first time you see them, they're complaining about money troubles, but yet she bought like three or four tickets. It's like, well, I don't know how much you actually have money problems if you're dropping $400 on lottery tickets.
Yeah, and I mean, Beast even says you work part-time in a bookstore. But I kind of feel like you couldn't afford to dress the way she does, live in that fancy apartment, and drop all that money on lottery tickets for something that's virtually worthless.
Well, I mean, also, maybe if the Fables own the building outright, then they just don't have to pay rent, and that's part of the... Or they get a super reduced rent rate. something like that. There's got to be, I'm sure there's some underlying trick built into it, but you're right, it does sort of break up the integrity of that scene where Beauty and Beast are complaining about money and it's causing their marital problems. Which, by the way, that scene was great.
Yeah, I like that scene, actually.
It's great because it sets tone for what this world is like for them and how they have the exact same problems you do, except for they've been having them for 1,000 years. So what about some of these other characters? Is there anybody that stuck out for you guys that you really liked? I mean, David, I know you said that you liked Bigby. Is there somebody that you really liked, Jen?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I really loved Bigby, and his really awkward attempt to hit on Snow White was, like, that. I thought that was a really good ending for the story because it perfectly characterized him. He's, like, a nice guy who's not really socialized well, and it just drew a good portrait of him and was a good way to close. On the other hand, someone I really liked the rendition of, but also have torn feelings on, is Cinderella. Because she's a badass in this. She's learning fencing from Bluebeard. At the same time, like, it seems like all these ladies are getting the gritty princess thing going on. I guess, if that is a thing.
Yeah, and definitely.
It is. There's a couple remakes of these old stories that have been in theaters lately. Like, was it called? Mirror, Mirror? There was one
in The Huntsman.
Yeah, yeah, where the woman is the lead character and takes up the sword and saves herself from the story.
Yeah, I kind of feel like when you make a... I feel like it's undermining something else when you take a princess and then say, okay, we're going to have a feminist perspective on this, so she's going to be a different kind of stereotype. Because it's not just that she's strong and capable and a warrior, she's also a potty mouth and kind of vitriolic. And it's, I don't know, I feel like if you're going to have strong princess, take it like Mulan style instead of, you know, turd sandwich Cinderella.
Yeah, that was a little bit out of... Go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say, I think even Snow White is creeping into that territory in a different way. She reminds me of kind of like Lois Lane in the Superman cartoon. She's like a badass, and she's not a badass, but she's reckless. And I get that notion with Snow White, but then at the same time, she kind of still is a little whiny and needs saving. Mm-hmm. Not trying to say that like all princesses need saving, but that's kind of like the thing about fairy tales, right?
Yeah, in every fairy tale, there's somebody to save, and you could be feminist about it and flip the person who needs saving, or flip even the thing that needs saving. I mean, some of these movies, the kingdom is what needs saving, and the princess saves the kingdom. And they just remove gender from it entirely. But regardless, there's something that always needs saving.
Right.
I think not all these characters fall into that. I mean, Cinderella definitely falls in that trap of going in the too hardcore direction. You know, and I was thinking about rationalizing it and saying, well, Cinderella's changing up her character, and the language isn't just her, it's pervasive. Almost everybody in this comic cusses at least once by the time we get to the end of Volume 1. But then you brought up the turd sandwich remark, and that really is like, yeah, that's kind of juvenile and cursy.
Yeah.
Kind of smacked that down. But then you also get, like Beauty and Beast, and I don't remember Beauty ever saying anything that was too much like that. I mean... Granted, they're shown to us in the beginning as the typical couple, long-term relationship, happily married, but, you know, realistically happily married.
You know, I really liked that, too, because if you think about it, they're not doing the uncivil bickering thing that you often see, where it's like, you know, the woman's complaining about his cleanliness, and he's complaining about her being a bitch or something. You know, he's actually a pretty nice guy to her, as far as we can see.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even though they're having an argument, she's a pretty nice guy to him, or pretty nice girl to him, too, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they both are good people and good-intentioned, and it's a frustrating moment.
So maybe not the, you know, grittiness with them, but I don't know. Like, I feel like it's these divorced princesses. And
but you know what? You know, that's something that would need... Okay, so I want to talk about the divorcing thing with these princesses, because that's something that would need to be reconciled, right? If you have all of these princesses who married Prince Charming, and they're all together in one place, either they're all cool with polygamy, right? Or Prince Charming just divorced them serially, and like he was a serial monogamist. He wouldn't, you know, be married all to them at once, but, you know, marry, divorce, marry, divorce, marry, divorce, marry, divorce. And he would have to be like that. So you got to figure they've all been divorced. And for right or for wrong, I think that's a lot of the rationalization maybe for why some of these characters have grown more gritty. You know, you get somebody like Cinderella who comes out of that divorce and says, well, I guess I need to learn how to take care of myself because there's no Prince Charming to save me. I mean, you could rationalize it, but I feel shitty saying that a divorce is a rationalization for a woman becoming stronger.
So they have to go suffer. They have to be kicked to the curb to pick themselves up.
I don't understand why, thinking of the rationality behind it, why the relationship has to be the reason for her wanting to learn swordplay.
Yeah.
It's not linear. It works if you don't think about it. It's just it's non-linear. But that does bring me to one of my favorite characters of the story, which is Prince Charming. I think his character is miraculously pulled off exactly the way that he would have to be. Right? Because taking all of this comic at face value, right, saying all of these things really did happen with real people just in another realm where magic exists and now they're here, if this one guy, Prince Charming, really exists, he would have had to have been exactly like this. A really shitty guy. He would have had to have been a giant douchebag, but at the same time be so disarmingly charming, handsome, and such an incredible womanizer that he could also completely get away with it. He would have to be exactly this guy. I think if there's anything in this character, anything in this trade that's done exceptionally well, and there are a couple things that are done really well, but if there's, for me, the best pulled off thing in this comic is Prince Charming.
I can back that. Yeah,
I think I agree with that.
All right then.
You were correct, sir.
The other character I really liked was one of the princesses. I really liked Snow White. She's exactly what I look for in a comic book character. The incredibly strong female character. What did you guys think of her? Because she's the driving... I think she's the protagonist of the story. I mean, her and Bigby.
Yeah, definitely.
What did you guys think of our protagonist then?
I liked her. She seems like... You know, this is going to sound weird, but she seems like she's adjusted well to her situation, and she's just trying to take care of everybody else. For someone whose sister is potentially dead, she's handling it pretty well, though. I thought that was kind of strange, maybe. But, I liked her. I know earlier I said that she seemed like she was a little bit, you know, she was kind of the person who was one of the examples of a grid, like a gritty remake of a character, but I think she works better than Cinderella does.
Yes.
So, I liked Snow White, but I kind of felt like she actually kind of was too upset about her sister, which is kind of the opposite of what you said, David. Because I don't know, I've never had a sibling, so maybe that affects it. Or I've never had, like, a really close family member around my age. So I don't know what that would be like, but it seemed like they were estranged and that at some times Snow White was such a stone-cold bitch and at other times she was so weepy. And I think, I mean, it did work well to balance her and make it seem like she wasn't just one stereotype or the other. But at the same time, I always felt a little confused about how she actually felt about Rose Red, especially because Bigby kept calling her a suspect, and that made me suspect her as well, I guess.
Yeah, and it's because it's, I think, it's because it's such a big break for her character. You wrote in the notes, Jen, I mean, I wrote that I really love this character a lot, and that you say sometimes she takes on that Ice Queen too much, which of course fits perfect for her name, right? Snow White. It builds that association immediately in your mind. But it's true. She is like that in this story. And so when you see her have these moments where she breaks down into like bawling tears, like you can see the tears streaming down her face, it's super out of character. And these moments, it's like she flips that switch really quick from being cool and collected while Bigby is grilling, what's his name, Jack? When he's grilling Jack so hard, then she just breaks. And it's almost out of nowhere. It doesn't give you time to build into it and see that coming and feel it coming in hers. It's a quick switch.
Yeah, and she apologizes for it too, and that kind of makes a bigger deal about it. And it's like so much of the waterworks, right? So instead of a few tears and her being like sniffly, it seems like out of nowhere she just goes ah, and then stops and it's like sorry about that, and then later she goes ah, again and then stops. So maybe it's part of the art and the way it transitioned.
No, I got the notion that she was like flippy like that. Now that we think about it, I think I kind of focused on the bitchy part. So
so if these are the female characters that we're getting, right? We're getting Snow White, we're getting Cinderella the way that she's done, we're getting Beauty, who is the one who seems to be the most normal, or at least rational, well-adjusted of the group, at least one without a glaring personality flaw, other than she's not having a perfect marriage. What do you see in this comic that makes this, that gives this comic the stigma of it being a girl comic? And I say that because whenever you see a list, these lists pop up every once in a while online if you follow certain blogs. It's a list of like how to get your girlfriend to read comics, comic books to give your girlfriend to read. This is always on that list. Without fail, Fable is on that list.
I have so much to say on this topic. So if I get going, feel free to just shut me up.
No, I'm curious because we get these characters and like you say, Cinderella is a loudmouthed, immature brat. I mean, basically, that's the way we see her now. She's a little bit empowered in that she's trying to, you know, learn up and defend herself. Snow White is a strong character, yeah, but she's that cold bitch stereotype through and through, you know? Like, what in here makes this a girl comic? Is it even, I mean, aside from the sexism of these lists, taking that away from this equation.
Two-prong approach here. The first issue is that, I mean, whether we like it or not, we live in a world that is extremely gendered. And that starts basically, it starts before birth. I mean, take any baby shower, pink and blue, you know, whether it's a boy or a girl, that sort of thing. You buy gendered clothing before your kid is even born. So girls are trained to love princesses. No matter how tomboyish they are, almost every girl at some stage in her life wants to be a princess because you're told, you know, this is the ideal. These are women who are graceful, beautiful, thin, pretty, and also powerful, and they always get the guy. So marketing princesses to girls works, especially if they're grown-up princesses. Snow White could be a freaking Manhattan lawyer, you know, wielding her cell phone and doing, you know, having political involvements. Cinderella is a badass who fences, and it's easy to dispose of their flaws if you're kind of focusing in on like, hey, princesses. And I mean, I know a lot of girls, more girls than guys, just anecdotally, who are still obsessed with Disney.
Yeah.
And it's just like this thing. So, I mean, we live in a society that tells girls princesses are good. So you see princesses and they're like, yeah, I like that. And maybe that's what men think girls want too. I don't know. The other half of this is And I'm going to refer to something that just went viral, and that's the Hawkeye and Lady Poses blog. Have you guys seen this?
I haven't actually looked at it, but I've seen it come up on Facebook and stuff.
Seen some reblogs, yeah.
So I have granted, some of the poses they mock, they can't talk good. Some of the poses they mock aren't that bad. But others, especially like the really Rob Liefeld ones, are really ridiculous. And you see women twisted in these strange positions that are not anatomically possible in order to get both tits and ass in the shot. And, I mean, there's a reason that blog went viral, because it's a problem in comics that we've been talking about for years and years mm-hmm. and years. And something that people say keeps women out of the comics industry and keeps it, you know, as a thing for nerdy man children.
Yeah.
And this doesn't portray women in a horribly unrealistic fashion.
Yeah, yeah. Come to think of it, it's not something I noticed when I was reading it, but yeah, I can't recall any posing like that.
Even in very plunging dresses, we see Snow White and we see Beauty and a bunch of other ladies, and they just look like normal human beings. I mean, they're well proportioned. They look nice because they're fairy tale princesses and therefore have to be unrealistic to some degree. Mm-hmm. But they don't look ridiculous in any way. They look possible.
And when they are drawn more, I mean, when they're drawn for the gala, right? And they're put in a position where a character in the comic book would have a gaze for them, right? That scene I'm thinking of specifically with Bigby and Snow White dancing. Like, it's brought up and addressed immediately, and Snow White puts the kibosh on it right away. Right? Like, that scene was pretty entertaining.
Yeah, and... Oh, sorry, I'm gonna backpedal just a little.
Sure.
Not backpedal, backtrack. Another horrible stereotype that we see in comics, and that I think girls are also taught to believe to some degree, societally, is action movies and superheroes are dumb and that's for boys. The same way that sometimes you'll see young ladies looking at things like Call of Duty and be like, it's so stupid, why would you want to shoot people? Well, it's fun, just like comics can be fun, but I think there's more, aside from just like princesses are good, it's this idea that, hey, you don't have to read any of that stupid superhero stuff with a bunch of goofy characters and spandex.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's my piece.
It sounds to me like some of the reasoning is the superficial. I think you're right. I think a lot of it is these lists come up and people think, well, what are girls like? They like princesses. Well, here's a comic with princesses. And I think that is the superficial thing of why it gets on these lists and why a lot of less educated, I would want to say, comic book retailers recommend this when people bring them such a question. But I think at the same time, it is a comic that strazzles a lot of strong female characters, and it misses all of the problems that push people away from reading comics, right? Like, I mean, you're entirely right with the costume stuff. I love Power Girl. I love her character. I love her comics. I love her story. But for some people, that costume is an impasse. I have friends who I know would love the comic book, who I know would love the character and enjoy reading the book, but they absolutely refuse to even open the cover because they see the character, they see the way she's drawn, they see the costume, and it's just immediately no. And this doesn't do that. I mean, from the cover, it changes that perception, right? I mean, these covers, do you get to see the covers, Jen, in the trade?
Oh, yes.
I mean, these covers are beautiful. They're watercolor. They're shit you would hang on a wall. Right? It's not, like you say, spandex on a cover. You know, what's this guy in spandex punching things hard? What does that matter? No, these covers are fucking beautiful. As a matter of fact, I have a collection of James Jean art, and I think one of them was a cover for this. And it's like, from the very cover, it changes that perception of comics. And I think it does it because it's part of Vertigo's label, and it does it a lot of the same ways that probably Sandman used to do, like you were saying earlier, Jen. So I get why it's on this list for the superficial reasons, but I think it literally does belong on them, too.
It's accessible. And, you know, honestly, when I think about comics lists, I try to think about it in terms not so much of what would girls like, what do guy friends like, but what's accessible to an outsider. And this is fresh and new. You don't have to have read 500 issues to know what's going on, right? I mean, it's limited in its scope, and that is something that gets rid of some of the intimidation of comics as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that another thing that works in this in its favor is that it's a good example of what someone can do with the comics medium. Because when you go up to anybody that's not familiar with comics, they're going to assume that, just like we've been saying this whole time, it's spandex and people punching and, you know, Superman and Spider-Man and all those kinds of things. But there's a whole, just like TV isn't all reality shows and, you know, reality shows. comics can do a lot of different things. And this is a really good example of something that's, you know, completely opposite of superheroes. You wouldn't necessarily need to tell this story with a comic, but it could be a novel, right? I think when I was doing research on it, there was actually the first Fables stories were prose, not a comic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they include one in the trade as well. Okay.
And so this is why, like Jen said, this isn't necessarily just a comic that's for girls, but it's a comic for people who aren't into comics. My wife, for example, she doesn't really read comics, but one comic that she read for a really long time was, it was called Anita Blake Vampire Hunter, and it's based on a series of novels. I don't really know much about it, but it's not a superhero comic as far as I can tell. It's kind of like a detective-y type of thing. And, you know, so there's a lot of those comics out there, but we don't hear about them most of the time. Because the things that about comics that make the news is when Captain America dies or when Peter Parker dies, and now there's a African-American / Hispanic Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And see, to me as a comic book reader, that's not really news, right?
It's yeah, like, oh my god, okay. A character died in comics. It's only been happening since comics began.
Yeah, a character died and now we have a new character and he's not, you know, why does it matter that why is it scandalous that he's not, you know, that he's no longer a white guy? I don't know, I'm going down a different tunnel here, but I think what I'm trying to say is that there's a lot of good stuff that you can, there's a lot of good entertainment in comics that isn't the typical superhero stuff.
No, and you make a good point. I mean, a lot of the, if your perception of comics has nothing to do with anything we know about comics, right? Your perception is just the general stigma of them. You go into a comic book store, you see nothing but superhero stuff, and whenever you hear about comics in the news, it's because somebody died, and it seems sad and silly, and they're changing something, and you don't know why it's being changed. The rile, I don't think, was over the fact that the new Spider-Man is an African-American. I think the rile was like, well, what was wrong with Peter Parker? Why you gotta do this? And it's like, well,
there was some rile over that, I think.
Yeah, probably, but I'm gonna give humanity the benefit of the doubt. I mean, but I think people who don't read them don't realize, like, there's an issue that comes out every month. And Spider-Man's been around for, what, 50 years now? You got to shake shit up somehow. You got to change some stories. And as soon as you think about that, you think about the huge burden behind all of this spandex. And then this comic just is missing all of that. There's none of that burden here. And I think even some of the later comics, right? Fable does get into larger stories, but I'm pretty sure you could just randomly pick up Volume 5 and have a fun read. I mean, it feels like that kind of comic.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's talk about the art. What did you guys think of the way that this was drawn? I know the artist changes in the next volume, when it changed back. I know it's not the same artist the entire run, but what did you guys think of this one?
It struck me as very, oh my god, what's his name? The guy who does the comics pop art. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
He does those famous paintings that are based on actual comics, and he just kind of stole it.
Yeah, I know. I can't think of the name.
It starts with an L, but the only name that's coming to mind is Rob Liefeld, who is completely not that... is it Lichtenstein?
That sounds good. That sounds correct.
Roy Lichtenstein. Lichtenstein. Yes, it is. Okay. So, I guess what I'm saying is it feels like someone is emulating classic comics, or more accurately, like emulating art that's emulating classic comics, if that makes sense. Like, it's not quite 1950s, 1940s comics, but it has that vibe, especially in terms of the color.
Yeah, the coloring is, it's really flat. And I don't say that in a negative way, because I think that's really what makes this vibe happen. Because the colors are flat, there's a lot of washing out that happens, at least in what I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
The way that I've read it on digital copies, so I don't know if it's different in print. But it's not like, I mean, you go out, you pick up any title from DC, there are so many shadows, contours, there's digital rendering behind a lot of the art nowadays, especially something like Green Lantern you think of, you know? There is so much depth to that art, so many layers that get shuffled on top of it to make that depth happen. And this comic doesn't have that. And it gives it that really good faux classic feel that makes it feel like a comic. It's inviting that way. It's not like... the other thing I was thinking is it's not super stylized either. It's not like if you pick up... crap, what's the one that David McKean did? The Batman one that we read.
Arkham Asylum.
Yes, that has a huge barrier to entry for a non-comic book reader. Somebody who doesn't read comics would pick that up and go, how the fuck do I look at this?
I read a lot of comics and I thought had the same reaction.
Yeah, and it's like, because there's so much stylizing that happens nowadays, everybody feels like they got to do something to stand out in the world of comic books, and I think this art stands out in the fact that it is what it is, and it happily moves forward with that. Like, we're going to look like a comic book from 20 years ago, but we're going to make it look good.
Yeah. You said that, like, way better than I did.
Yeah, but I just said your idea over again, because I didn't have one of my own.
Let's say you're an editor.
There we go. Mm-hmm. The only thing I really did want to say is that what I like about this art a lot, the lack of stylization helps it, and I think that that helps the idea of place and setting end up being in our real world. Because, I mean, if you think about our real world, it's not going to be stylized. If you really want to drive home the sense of reality to your reader, you're not going to have it be, you know, super stark contrast, like full page spreads. It's not going to look like Hellboy.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to look as close to the real world as you can, and as close to what a comic book portrayal of that real world should look like. And I like that on top of that, there's always a lot of detail in the foreground and the background.
Oh, I was going to say that.
Okay, then you talk about it.
There's a couple. I have some examples that I pulled up here.
Well, it's here.
So there's one in, I think it's in issue one, where Bigby and Snow White are walking up the stairs to Rose Red's apartment, and you see Bigby's shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wolf's shadow. It's the wolf wearing a trench coat.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. But my favorite of them all is actually is also an issue one. It's where Prince Charming is having sex with the waitress. And it's like a full, it's like a kind of a backed up shot of her house,
mm-hmm.
or her apartment, but you can see the other sides of the walls.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a little kids listening up against the wall on one side.
There was?
And then there's on another wall on the outside, there's an old lady kind of like looking at the wall, kind of weird. And then there's even the shadow of a little like rat running across the, like it's running in the ceiling. I don't know. I just thought it's like, you know, those walls could have been gutters or something in the comic, right? But the penciler took the time to draw all these little details in, and it And it makes this scene of Prince Charming having sex with this lady, it makes it part of the world, right? Because if it was just a room, you know, it could be any room. It could be a room in a castle. It could be a room in a cabin. It doesn't matter. But this says, okay, look, now they're in this world where, you know, the things they do are noticed by other people. You know, there's these kids listening to the wall, and there's this old lady. And it's just kind of like, it's fun little details, and it also makes it kind of, it, like you said earlier, Andy, it makes it realistic.
Yeah, and it really helps you relate to it too, right? I mean, we've not all lived in it, but everybody's been in a shitty apartment with paper-thin walls with a fucking old woman next door who has nothing better to do in her day but sit around and listen to you and whatever the fuck you're doing. You know, and on the other side, there's these damn kids that always make noise, except for when you're doing something interesting, and that's when they shut up and listen. You know, like, everybody's... If you've not even been in this apartment, you know the trope.
Yeah.
I think my best example of the detail, though, is the whole story with the pig.
Yes.
There's so many panels where he's just in the background. Yeah. Like, there's a bunch of panels where it shows his, like, story through these five issues, which is kind of cute. But there's a bunch of stuff where, like, I think it was when Snow White and Prince Charming were in the breakfast diner. And the pig is, like, in the truck breaking out.
Yeah.
Like, in the background of their conversation. Like, that stuff helps the two intertwine, too. You see the realism of the coffee, like, the diner, right? You get the booths, you get all the... Like, I love that establishing shot of them in the diner because they're there in the booth, but the shot's coming from behind the counter. So you see a dude sitting at the counter with his coffee. You see the person pouring the coffee. You get the whole establishing shot of the diner so you can build it in your mind. You're like, okay, we're in the real world where real things happen, and these are two people having a real-world conversation. Except then the next frame outside, there's a fucking mystical pig breaking out of a truck because it doesn't want to go back into the farm. Like, that stuff does a great job of intertwining the two together, and that I think is the great strength of the art in this comic.
So while we're on the pig, I just want to point out, in case any listeners didn't notice, in every cover for these issues that are collected here, he's in it somewhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so the first one, yeah, he's like in the tree. There were two where I had trouble. The cover with Rose Red disguised. He's actually the graffiti in the background.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Let me go look at that.
And then, let's see, there's a really cute one where it's Cinderella and Bluebeard fencing. Mm-hmm. His butt's, like, peeking out somewhere. It's a nice touch.
All right. Well, I think I'm spent.
Do you Shall guys we rate it?
Mad?
No.
All right. You get to go first, Jen.
Okay. I liked this a lot better the second read through. And I think I caught all the little details this time, or a lot of them, and that really helped, because you could tell this was in many ways a labor of love. And I would say, like, I thought it was well-written. I liked the detective aspect of it, and I thought they did a really good job with that genre. I love the art. I think it's beautiful. The only failing at this point might be the characters still seem a little stereotypical. But, you know, a couple years ago I put this aside and was like, that was a good read. Now I actually want to go through and read more, because I want to see how they develop, and I also really want to know what's up with the adversary and if they get the homelands back, which, you know, I'm sure they will, because that's how these stories always work. But how will it happen? That's what is interesting to me. So 3.5, because I think I will keep reading this, and I enjoyed it.
All right. David?
Alrighty. So I'm sure all of you remember, at the beginning of this episode, I said I didn't really have much to say about this comic, and I didn't have any strong feelings about it. But after we've talked about it a bit, and especially after Jen said that she liked it a lot better the second read-through, I'm going to read these five issues again at some point. Because now that we've talked about it and I've kind of thought more about some of the things that I encountered through the comic, I think I would enjoy it if I tried again.
Okay.
So with that in mind, I'm going to give it a, based solely on this read-through, I'm going to give it a 2.5. I didn't think it was a bad comic, and I don't think it was the comic's fault that I didn't really enjoy it this time around. I thought some of the characters were interesting. I didn't love all of them. You know, some of them were kind of hit or miss. I didn't care about Jack or, you know.
Yeah. Jack, well, or what's the King Cole? Like, King okay, Cole. Great. He's a, I forgot the word, stock character.
Yeah. But I really did like the art a lot. It wasn't like super flashy art, but it worked really well in the story. And like we talked about, it really drove the setting home, because just like we live in a plain world, the art was kind of not plain, but it was like, here's the reality of the situation. There's no whams and things when people are punching each other and things like that, you know? So I think I'm going to give it a 2.5, and I'm going to read it again, and we'll see. I think I will probably like it more the next time around.
You know, I think that is almost exactly what I would have said for American Vampire. I'm just thinking there's so many comics that I've had that exact same sentiment for, where like we finished the discussion, I'm like, yeah, there was a bunch of great stuff about this comic, but for reasons I can't explain, just pure subjectivity, and it was okay.
Yeah.
You know, we've done a bunch like that where I've thrown that out there and you guys have been like, what the fuck? This was great. But I'm going to give it a 3.5. I think the story is cool. We didn't talk about plot too much. We talked about how it was a mystery and how it was nice that it was solvable. And I think that was its strength, is that it was solvable and then it had multiple motives built into it. But I mean, honestly, I've read, like I said earlier, I've read like 10 volumes of this or something. And I had honestly forgotten this story where it was in continuity. I had no idea that this story was the first one. And granted, it's a great premise for a first story because you get to go around and meet all the characters. You get to grill them. You get to interview everybody, right? You get to do character introduction flawlessly built into the story, which is smart. It's just not as exciting as it could be. You know, you don't get to see all these other characters that maybe you want to see if you're coming to this because you really like fairy tales, right? I mean, if you are the girlfriend who gets shafted with her boyfriend's comic, like, hey, baby, we should get to read comics. I saw on the internet that girls like princesses. Here you go. Right? Like, if you get shafted with that, you're going to be disappointed because this only gives you, like, two princesses. One of them you don't really see, and one's a cold bitch. Right? And, like, I love that cold bitch, but that's just me. But it doesn't flesh everything out maybe the way you're hoping it will. But God, the way the character and setting work together and the way that the art helps the two blend. And like Jen said, the way that it just feels like this vintage art, but modernized and not overdone, but just enough detail. Like it all just, it works. And I think it gets better. I think if you like this, definitely keep reading. It gets a lot better. It's not nearly as serial as this is. Jack gets a spinoff comic called Jack of Trades or Jack of Fables. So if you didn't care about him, don't worry, he leaves.
Oh.
And I hear his comic is actually better now than Fables is now. But I don't know. I don't like him, so I didn't read it. Yeah, so 3.5. I'm gonna give it 3.5. Just it feels right. It feels good. So that's it for this week. Next week we're gonna get down serious to the hardcore fantasy literature. We're going to go with King Arthur, the mother of fantasy literature. But we're going to do, of course, comics just can't do something straight. It has to do some fun interpretation on it because it's comics. If you want to read King Arthur, go pick up Le Morte d'Arthur. If you want a comic book King Arthur, we're going to set that motherfucker in the year 3000. So we're going to read
Arthur.
We're going to read Space Science Fiction Future Arthur. We're going to read Camelot 3000 by Mike W. Barr. It's from 1982. I think it's like 15 issues, but it goes real quick. There's a trade you can pick up it's probably used at your local comic book store. They probably have a copy. This thing has tons of awards to its name. They have a really, really beautiful, like, collector's hardbound edition that I saw on Amazon for, like, $15.
Man, does it really have a lot of awards?
I'm pretty sure it does. And you know what, though? This is a really good piece of Arthurian literature, too. If you like Arthur and you don't give a crap about comics, I don't know why you're listening to a comic book podcast, but if you don't give a crap about comics and like King Arthur, this is worth adding to your collection, too. I'm really going to pimp this thing because I love it to death. So that's what we're going to do next week. Until then, if you want to know all the ways that you can buy it, you can head to www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com, where you can also learn about past, future, or present shows, or past shows, and other words that aren't coming to my mouth because it's the end of the episode. You can learn about all kinds of different stuff at the website, which is www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. You can also hit us up on Gmail,
which is atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
Please follow us on the social medias, facebook.com/APSupercast or twitter.com/APSupercast. I'm pretty sure they're the same feed either way. So whichever you prefer, subscribe there. We'd appreciate it. We're trying to post more, put up some fun stuff, covers, art from things, you know.
Please like us.
Yeah, please. It'll be nice. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
Yeah.
Not Stitcher. Okay, maybe Stitcher.
You know, I still have no idea if Stitcher works. I wouldn't recommend it. Have you tried looking for it again, David?
No, I have not.
I downloaded it on another device, and I still couldn't find our show. And Stitcher, I've emailed them, and they have sworn up and down that it's listed. Yeah, all you got to do is search for Atomic Powered Supercast, and it comes up. We see it right here. It comes up. But I can't ever see it right, and I don't know what's wrong, and they won't help me figure it out. So don't subscribe on Stitcher. Subscribe on iTunes. Because at least it works. All right, everybody. Until next week. Goodbye.
Bye.